We welcome our political commentators. Today it's Neil Jones and Bridget Morton. Kia ora korua.
Kia ora.
Welcome. Neil was Chief of Staff to the Labour leader Jacinda Ardern and prior to that to Andrew Little, now Director of Public Affairs firm Capital. Bridget's a Director with public and commercial law firm Franks Ogilvie and a former Senior Ministerial Advisor for the previous National Led Government, a National Party member, and she volunteers during election campaigns for the party's Deputy Leader, the Finance Minister Nicola Willis. I mean, honestly, Friday, was it? Thursday and Friday, the power pylon falls over. 100,000 homes lose power in the north. Some sort of patching together happens on that. An investigation gets underway. And then the Inter-Island Ferry, Aratiri, grounds itself, barely having left Picton, believed to be because of a steering system failure. This on the back of the Defence Force's plane fail. The Brinduans have been closed for months. State Highway 1 again. The capital's water woes. It was kind of symbolic. I mean, I appreciate it's far more than that. It was actually extremely dangerous. But as a symbol of where things are at, can each of you speak?
Yeah, I mean, each of those has their own sort of political overlay on it, but fundamentally it goes back to the fact that as a country we don't invest in infrastructure like we need to. The Infrastructure Commission says we've got a $200 billion infrastructure gap that is growing every year. They've said that we need to double our infrastructure spending for the next 30 years to catch up. And the last budget, I don't think, did catch up. In fact, if anything, we're going backwards. And last year we had population increase as a country of a city the size of Tauranga. So if you look at that, I think we actually have to get serious as a country about probably taxing what we need to tax and spending what we need to spend on infrastructure. I think quite often what you find is infrastructure spending isn't very sexy. And Wellington Water is a great example where for decades councillors campaigned on keeping rates low because who wants to promise on higher rates to fix something underground no one knows about or sees? It's only when water starts spewing everywhere and there's poo running down the streets, everyone suddenly says, oh my goodness, why wasn't this fixed earlier? And so it's these crisis moments where we realise that, you know,
people talk about the infrastructure broken. It's actually an illustration of how politics is broken.
Oh, it is.
That successive governments and councils can go decades. And to be fair to Wellington, there's an earthquake issue, I think, that's underweighted post the 2016 Kaikoura earthquake. But it is a massive political systemic failure, is it not, Bridget?
I think absolutely from the investment point of view, it is undoubtedly, because yeah, people don't want to spend those billions. I mean, the NZDF plane is the ultimate. Whilst, you know, we say we need it for Defence Force, we need it to go and pick up people from New Caledonia, the people associated with getting the Prime Minister around the world, therefore nobody wants to be the government that pays for that plane to be upgraded at the cost of some other local infrastructure. So that's absolutely a political issue. But I think just going back to what are the symptoms, I think we concentrate too highly on the money, the number and how much money is needed. Ultimately, we have some of the most expensive infrastructure building costs in the world in New Zealand. Whereas something like, you know, depending on what list you are, whether in the top 10 or the top 5, it's extraordinary. And some things we can't change. We're at the bottom of the world in the middle of the Pacific. But lots of things we can change. And I think if, you know, we're going to see actually politics working and actually something changing, National will have to deliver. And I think they're pointing themselves in the right direction on some of these things that are actually slowing down some of those builds. So that is the RMA, earthquake prone building. All of that kind of stuff has to change because we simply cannot tax our way to having gold plated infrastructure in the country.
Come back to the weekend, please. Come back to the Inter Islander. And many people are fortunate that out of the last two incidents, we are not talking about one of the most catastrophic, fatal events in the country's history, right? That ship just couldn't steer, it seems, and went straight into an island barely out of Picton. If that had happened at a different place in a different time, and same back in January, drifting towards the rocks off the coast of Wellington, how do we get to a point where there's only one ferry operating at the moment on State Highway 1 carrying freight and passengers, and we know these ferries are end of life and we know they have been for years? How do we get here?
Well, I mean, I think it has been decades of underinvestment, but also, I mean, in the specific one, the previous Labor government was told about 2021 there was an issue. They made a decision to invest. Now, to be fair, it sounds like QRL did blow that cost out a bit and that had to be looked at. Even Grant Robertson was like saying before the election that he had an issue with it. But you know, we had an incoming government that wanted to grandstand about the previous government, make a political point, and cancelled IREX, and now has no idea how it's going to replace the ferries. At the same time they were cancelling IREX, they were giving $3 billion of tax cuts to landlords. I think that's a perfect illustration, actually, of what's wrong with our infrastructure in this country, is that it's far too often it's a political pawn, it's short-term thinking, and politicians don't make the right decisions.
I don't think it was that political grandstanding. I think what was really clear is they came into government and realised, when you say a bit blown out, it was an extraordinary blowout, and on things which Kiwi Rail shouldn't.
The ships are a good deal
exactly, but
at
we
the moment.
But we couldn't get the ships in without...
The port-side infrastructure. But...
No, just going back to, so just, you know, talking about it being political grandstanding, and that was the problem, I absolutely disagree with it. National, or that none of the coalition partners campaigned on cancelling insurance. They weren't like suddenly a giant ferry, you know, a whole bunch of voters came out and went, yes, you've cancelled the ferries. That was actually going to be more costly to them politically, I think, by making that announcement straight off than not. But they knew, looking straight at the books, it's simply we could not afford it.
Yeah, but to Neil's point, it was also in the costs of we're going to save all this money and we won't be borrowing for tax cuts.
Because the reality
right?
is, yeah, when you're in government, there are costs that emerge you don't expect. Like, there are costs blow out, costs grow, things happen. And that's why you can't sell that close to the wind. And the incoming government's budget was extremely tight. They had a very ambitious tax cut plan, and they didn't leave the money needed. And so I think the politics of it was, don't spend this money because we need this money elsewhere.
Come back to the current situation. When we interviewed Peter Reedy, I think it was in December, not long after the cancellation of the project, he said... In an interview, we can scale back those port side costs. We went gold plated. We were looking at, you know, a 100-year lifespan. It is, in Wellington's case, right on a fault line. But he said we can scale those costs back. That never got traction. The thing went. My question to you now is the government going to look at a $550 million build for those ships that are being built anyway? We're going to own them. We're going to sell them. And does it go back and say... Do we now revisit what happens port size? Is that politically palatable?
Well, yes. I mean, Richard Harman this morning had a piece where it looks like the government may not have actually cancelled the contract yet for the ships. There is a world where they can go back to what Graham Robertson was doing, which is to say, hang on, Kiwi Rail, you've got a bit out of hand here. Let's see what we can do to scale back these costs, but continue with it. Because right now we've got a scenario where if they continue with IREX in some form, 2026 we can have new ferries up and running. If they don't... I can't see where they're getting the ferries from, and I can't see where they get them within sort of
within the next 5 years. Well, the intentions to lease was what Nicola Willis was talking about. But now we're in the situation where you're wondering how many Band-Aids for how long. And the other thing is, Bridget, is it politically palatable to look at it in the new circumstance and say, let's have a relook at whether that portside infrastructure could be brought back into... A more palatable
Absolutely.
Figure.
I think that's what the Ministerial Advisory Group is doing. It's not like they cancelled it and said, oh, this is a problem for a couple of years away. They immediately put in, and I do agree, you know, advisory group is not, you know, unless they move with speed, and, you know, I think they need to come out with something very soon. They did put something in place in which to relook at all the options and reconsider.
Including IREX?
We simply couldn't afford. I'm not on the Ministerial Advisory Group. I can't tell you what options they're looking at. But I do think that it's just short-sighted for us to say we simply could not afford it. And I don't think it's... I think it's just really naive to say it was about tax cuts for landlords because, once again, they weren't tax cuts. That is just, you know, this is a massive infrastructure cost and you've actually got to invest it and make sure it's the right fit. And that was the problem. We'd end up with this gold-plated solution for something we didn't need gold-plated.
Again, though, I mean, for a start, we can afford things. We just choose what we fund. And we could afford the IREX plan as it was. It may not have been good value for money, and I think it was right to go back and have a look at it. But again, that wasn't the announcement. The announcement wasn't, we're going to review the current IREX plan. There was a big grandstanding announcement. They were cancelling IREX. It was an example of the previous government's
prolific. You've made your point.
My point is, though, like, this is now the new government's problem.
Well, it's got...
I don't think they're naive. It's got multiple
problems. And we can add in the Ministry of Education's building programme again, and the minister saying, why are we doing all these bespoke buildings where part of the funding comes from a board of trustees in a community that wants the latest all-black training gym and some grand stadium, you know. Is there a means by which we can get some sane, quasi-independent planning into these forward infrastructure projects? Yes, politicians are ultimately going to fund or not fund, But can we somehow have a system where much better planning is happening at scale?
Well, just go back to that schools one. And because I was involved in that, I worked in the Ministry of Education's office. The Associate Education Minister, Nikki Kaye, went through a big audit program with the Ministry of Education of all of our buildings and all of what needed to happen. And it was all prioritised. And then the budget was funded against, take the list, you know, the most urgent. Labor came in and threw that out the window. So we had an infrastructure plan around school buildings. We had a plan and that got thrown away. And for no, I don't understand, to be honest, why. And then, of course, like, you can't be naive to the fact that building costs just blew out over COVID, and that was a big push as well. But you can have that planning in place, but you have to rely on successive governments being actually practical about it and not being ideological.
But does it have to sit inside individual ministries? And, you know, in this case, a lot of focus on Kiwi Rail. We saw from the OIAs, the former Minister of Finance's eyes widening with every piece of new information and cost blowout came in. You know, it's on such scale across so many portfolios.
Well, that's the point of Cabinet. Cabinet is the point is that these issues come up. They decide, as Neil says, what gets prioritised for funding and what doesn't get prioritised for funding. Ultimately, the Minister is responsible, the Minister of Education is responsible, or who has got control of Kiwi for hours is responsible, and for that cost. And so that is where they need to make those priorities for infrastructure. It ultimately comes down to Cabinet, not some individual government department.
What people often talk about is the need
They provide the information, though. They provide the proposals. They provide the options. They provide the budget.
Yeah, but ultimately, it's Cabinet that is deciding.
And Cabinet says, and no, go back, and then nothing happens. This is my point.
I think what people often talk about is the need for some political certainty and some kind of bipartisan accord on infrastructure funding over the next couple of decades. I'm a little bit sceptical about whether that's politically feasible. I saw what happened with that housing accord under the previous government. I think the moment the politics changes and we live in a particularly volatile moment, I'm not sure that's plausible across governments. I don't know what the solution is, to be honest. I think maybe it's an issue for media and civil society to be more critical of governments that take short-term decisions and to be more critical of not making investments that need to be made. But it's hard, right? Like, everyone who owns a home is like, I could spend thousands of dollars fixing my roof, but I might have a few more years in it, so I'll go to Raro instead. You know, this is the decisions, this is human nature, and I think we struggle against that. And I don't think there's an easy answer.
Okay. So-called estimates or scrutiny week, which is, well, I mean, the estimates is not unusual. It's where ministers talk to their budgets and get widely questioned by select committees. It has been intensified a little with this new approach taken since a review of standing orders. Did we learn much more from any of those ministers? It was the first time we'd actually heard from any of them in any detail since the budget.
Yeah, I think scrutiny week or sort of estimates is something for the opposition to win. You know, we talk about budget day being, you know, government day, it's really hard for opposition to get any wins. You know, I spent time working in Australia. It's actually much more common to have exactly that kind of scrutiny week. I worked in Senate, in estimates, full-on week in which the opposition has a full plan in terms of narrative and rhetoric about exactly what we're pushing. And I think that's what I didn't see last week, was actually from the opposition. There was lots of bitsy things. You know, we found out a bit more about cancer drugs and why that decision wasn't made. We found a bit more about what's happening in conservation. We didn't get a strong message from the opposition about actually what they're most concerned about in the budget. And I think that's where there's a sort of lost opportunity. I'm assuming they're going to get better at it, you know, the first time that they've had a week like this. But that's where I think the lost opportunity in terms of accountability and transparency was, that the opposition needed to be a bit stronger.
I thought actually it was quite useful. I only watched a little bit of it. It was 134 hours, so I barely touched the sides. But I thought, so often in Parliament, it's grandstanding and theatre rather than actually being scrutiny. So question time, you know, that's all about making points, you know, getting one over the other side, getting them in a gotcha. I thought actually just watching MPs asking ministers about how things work and how things are funded, and that's useful. And some of that will end up being information that sort of informs future lines of attack. And I think we'll see it evolve as we go on. But I thought it was a really useful innovation.
There's that, and I think we've bemoaned in the past what's happened to select committees, full stop, sort of relegation.
Yeah, and I think there was some boundaries put around this scrutiny week that were a good improvement on that. You know, it's an allocation in terms of, you know, how many questions go to the opposition, how many go to government backbenchers. So, and the fact that they were allowing also I can't remember what they're calling it, but like a trail of questioning. So instead of just having your two questions move on, actually be able to interrogate the issue. So I think those are really good improvements because, yes, select committees over the last couple of years have become just patsies for the government.
Okay, let's have a look at what may come out of post-Cabinet today or later this week. One of the biggest matters of attention out of the budget was the failure for the promised cancer drugs, new cancer drugs, to be announced in it. Ever since the government's been promising it's coming, it's coming.
Mm.
Do we expect that out of today and this week we will see that promise fulfilled?
Yeah, I should declare my firm gives some advice to a pharmaceutical company, so but any opinions as always are my own. Look, I think the government will have to do something. There was a leak that Rachel Thomas from the Don Post managed to get up that they were going to be making an announcement following Cabinet today. This has been catastrophic for the government because when you promise 13 cancer drugs to people who are sick, are dying, have huge public sympathy, have nothing to lose and aren't afraid of going to media, that's always going to be a running sore. And it's kind of cast a pall over an otherwise relatively successful budget. And I think that there is a political imperative to fund those drugs to stop the bleed. I think that's pretty obvious to everyone. The challenge they've got is, of the three options, you know, the first one is you can just direct Pharmac. That breaks the Pharmac model and doesn't seem to be something David Seymour supports as Pharmac Minister. The other one is that you you fund another agency like Te Whatu Ora and say, can you go fund it? Again, that undermines the Pharmac model. So your only real option is just to give Pharmac the money to say, work your way down the options for investment list until you funded all those drugs. And that gets extremely expensive. So, you know, I've heard estimates of $500-600 million, which is a lot of money, which if that comes out of future budget allocations, that puts a huge squeeze on the government's budget on the operating allowance in future years. If you try and take it out of the current health budget, that's going to create huge other problems. So I think it's going to be quite fiscally challenging for the government, but politically they have to do something.
What way do you think they'll go with the options that Steve Meharry, a former Pharmac chair, outlined for us last week, broadly echoing what Neil said there?
Yeah, I think it's for them politically, obviously I completely agree with Neil at the fact that there is a massive political problem for them, particularly, and it did overshadow the budget. I think what they'll be careful to do, and I hope they'll be careful to do, is not break that Pharmac model, because they're just not only creating a public policy issue, but another political headache going down the track. The fact that, you know, this is how we can, you know, always be asked to fund Pharmac and break that independence. So I would hope that they're kind of keeping that intact. I think, though, that what was interesting that came out of Estimates last week was about that there was their policy issues. It wasn't about the funding. You know, there's been a lot of said, well, you funded this, but you didn't fund the cancer drugs. You funded this, but you didn't fund the cancer drugs. So I think that will help to cut that off when that funding is available there. But I think it has done some irreparable damage to the reputation.
Can I just say, though, I mean, I get that it's complicated, right? It is complicated how they do it. They did know how the Pharmac model works when they made that promise. Like, it's not news. It shouldn't have been a surprise to anyone how we fund drugs in this country. So when you promise 13 cancer drugs, the first question you should ask when you're putting that policy out there is, how does it actually work in reality?
What is mind-blowing about it is that some of these drugs no one's ever made an application for, no pharmaceutical company's ever made an application for. It's already an out-of-date list. If they don't tick off everyone, there's going to be someone who's affected, and yet actually the best decision may be to choose another option instead. And the other point that was made was they've handed over the negotiating power with these companies, Bridget, because when you know what the shopping list is and the pressure on the government to deliver, that's going to make bargaining a whole lot more difficult.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think there's some fundamental issues in this being a type of election promise, and I think, you know, there'll be probably some regrets around that table about making the promise in this way. I do understand, though, that this was a big, you know, election issue. It was a politically one that people did want to see action on. I think, you know, Rachel Smalley was very good as a journalist in persecuting this issue really strongly and had that public sympathy. So I can see why it's something that people voted on. I do agree, though, and I think something that came out of screen last week was Aisha Vero, and from the Labour spokesperson, really persecuting about the fact that, yes, she raised all these issues last year when the policy was announced and it wasn't listened to. So it wasn't a surprise to anyone going into the budget that these things need to be solved.
I think the safer thing for politicians is just to promise Pharmac increases. You know, we know Pharmac's got a list of options to invest list. We know there's a gap with Australia in terms of what they fund. If you simply say we're going to give Pharmac more money, then you leave it to Pharmac to fund what drugs they think are best, and you save yourself this kind of hassle.
Yeah, of course, one of the issues is the government came in and discovered, you know, the Pharmac fiscal cliff and the fact that they actually had to fund a big hole. So if they'd just done that, that funding would have gone into that hole and we wouldn't actually probably seen this additional $13 billion.
Well, they knew there was a fiscal cliff because that was in both their budget and Labour's budget, our fiscal plan. But yes, there was some more between PREFU and the government coming in. there was some more cost pressures that emerged.
Let's look at that question of opposition. You mentioned the opportunity that Scrutiny Week offered. I mean, obviously, not everyone's sitting and watching 134 hours, but if you get some wins, it's a way to get a story up and running, and a way to potentially to get under a minister's skin. What else are you making at the moment? It's been interesting watching Chris Hipkins over a few weeks now doing what I think one commentator called a round of mea culpa speeches, basically saying, we got this wrong, we got that wrong, sort of clearing the decks. Necessary?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, he at his speech to the Lower North Island Regional Conference, I think weekend before last, he sort of made 3 points of what they need to do. One is be a good opposition. Two is listen to why people left Labour. And three is build their movement and their capacity to campaign. I think those are the right. That's the right approach. I think Labour's biggest risk right now is complacency, which is that the polls are not great for the current government. A lot of polls show the centre-left ahead. And the preferred PM is far more level than it should be at this stage of the cycle. The risk for Labour, I think, is the reasons people were grumpy at them still exist. And so as well as just saying we've got a few things wrong and listening, I think Labour's going to have to demonstrate to the public, to people they lost, that they have changed in some areas where there were concerns. And that's hard.
It's going to be problematic within the party as well. No, because there are some really gnarly policy issues that are going to be resolved one way or another, particularly like, around tax.
Things like law and order, tax, the Treaty of Waitangi co-governance. There are lots of issues where Labour lost voters and has to have hard discussions internally and publicly.
Yeah, I agree. And I think he also needs to go through and sort of do this mea culpa process, because a large part of this was a lack of trust. And I think that's internally and externally. So internally, you've got that sort of flip-flopping on some of the tax policies. But externally, remember, you know, Hipkins was part of Ardern's cabinet. Immediately he became leader, he, you know, threw Harford on the policy bonfire, then took some quite ad hoc policies through the election, say GST on fruit and vegetables, etc., which I think, you know, diminishes exactly, well, what is Labour standing for? And so I think this process is about them rebuilding and going back to that sort of values of what Labour stands for and campaigning on that, because ultimately they have to differentiate themselves from National, going hard on law and order, where I think National and the Coalition have got a strong hold on that. It's probably not going to win them any votes, but they need to get back that trust that they won't come in and throw that all out.
Maybe a really good infrastructure plan. Maybe it's a word we're going to start understanding the meaning of.
Well, I mean, there is an issue there. I mean, there are some big economic challenges New Zealand faces, and Labour has an opportunity now in opposition to sort of reformulate how do we deal with things like infrastructure and immigration and wages and productivity.
The Greens, we should mention Marama Davidson on leave and being very open and upfront about her breast cancer diagnosis. Fortunately, it looks like it's a very good prognosis, but that party must be asking when the universe is going to give it a break this year. That said, we're still waiting for it to resolve the matter with its MP
Darlene Tana
on leave. On full pay, Darlene Tana. We kept waiting for this report to come. We still don't have this report.
Yeah, I think there's ultimately a trust issue going to happen for them as well, because people are like, well, when are you going to stop talking about yourselves and start talking internally? And I don't put Manawa Davidson's diagnosis in that bucket, but ultimately they haven't had a break. Some of it's completely out of their control, a lot of it within their control. I was discussing over the weekend with some people who are sort of Green Party supporters, and for them it's ultimately, you know, if I was like, well, it's National or Labour, Darlene Tana would have been gone months ago. There would have been the structure in place and the discipline implies that would have been cut off. They wouldn't have let this bleeding sore continue. But this has not happened within the Greens. And I think this is one of the issues with them being, you know, their cultivation of activists versus, you know, a political party, is the fact they don't have some of those disciplinary processes in place to actually go, this is doing us more damage politically. You're not adding any value to the people that you're elected to represent. Therefore, it's not appropriate to be here.
How do you do that with natural justice having to play its course? How do you do that?
Well, it comes down to the internal discipline. You know, just look at Luxon and how quick he was to act on ministers he felt weren't performing.
He's got the prerogative of sacking a minister. They serve it his will.
Yeah, but they serve it his will with the support of his caucus. So if he had sacked them and he did not have the support of the caucus to keep a high-performing cabinet going, he would not have been able to do it. And I think that's what we're seeing a little bit in the Greens at the moment, is that a little bit of a sort of a too flat a structure means that they are out struggling to, when they need to put the foot down, they're unable to do so.
Obviously wish Manama Davidson the best and a speedy recovery. On Darlene Tana, I can't understand why it's taken so long. There's obviously maybe more to it, but this is not a legal process. It shouldn't be a legal process. I know a lawyer's looking into it, but ultimately what you're looking at is, does she remain a Green MP? And that's a political decision for the Greens. And I think you've actually just got to sometimes make some hard calls, get the evidence you've got, and push on, because people want to see strong leadership.